The following program is intended for an audience that is blind or print impaired. I'm Kurt Benrud. Welcome to Science Fiction Shorts, brought to you by a team of volunteer readers. Our program will be available in podcast after the initial broadcast.
My name is Jennifer Green, and I will be reading To Be Undone of Such Small Things by Damian Walters Grintalis. Editor's note: the story that follows is disturbing. Use your discretion in choosing to continue. She sits in her car with her hands in her lap, staring at the glass doors of the facility. Tears shimmer in her eyes. Strange that she should never find healing through grief as others do. Strange that her heart cannot give up the barbed wire fragments it carries within. She wipes away the sorrow from her face and goes inside. A war veteran with half his face twisted into scars passes her in the hallway. He smiles. She knows what he wanted to give up. She wishes him 1,000 nights of peaceful sleep and shadows without enemies lurking in their darkness. The doctor smiles. She signs the papers. Yes, she understands the risks. Yes, she understands. But this is for the best. The paper robe scratches her skin. The table presses hard against her back. A nurse pats the back of her hand, latex to trembling flesh. The bite of antiseptic hangs heavy in the air. The white walls whisper of scalpels and needle sticks. The procedure isn't painless. A sensation of a million bees inside her skull, all stinging at once. The hurt grows too big to hold in, and she falls into darkness. When she wakes, she remembers her father kissing her on the head at bedtime and teaching her how to read, sitting on the floor of the bathroom and laughing as he put shaving cream on his face and growled before he scraped away the bristles. The aftershave lotion with its sharp scent and a ship on the bottle. Beyond that, there is a tiny space, a gray haze at the edge of a faded dream. She opens the journal they told her to keep and reads what they took away, her father leaving. All the days she spent waiting on the front steps, hoping today he'd come back. All the questions she asked her mother, the questions that remained unanswered. She lets out a small sigh. Maybe now she won't be so afraid to let someone close. Another addition to her journal. When the bees sting, she grimaces and clenches her fists, but she welcomes the pain. What she remembers: running to the car in the rain, holding the shopping bag with one hand and her keys in the other, the way her wet hair clung to her cheeks and neck. What the journal says is missing: the gun pointed at her head, rough hands shoving her into her car, the face above hers, his voice a sandpaper rasp in her ear, the sour reek of his sweat, and later, standing in the shower with hot water dancing on her skin, scrubbing hard enough to bleed, fearing she'd never be clean again. She tears out the page and rips it to shreds. She doesn't need the reminder. The hurt isn't hers anymore. Maybe now the touch of someone's hand on her skin won't feel like a million maggots hungry for the soft parts deep inside. A siphon taking out the bad. A fountain pen rewriting her story, erasing the shadows from her eyes and the thorns from her heart. And each time, another gray spot where the pain used to live. She remembers her mother pulling weeds from the garden, laughing all the while. The sweet perfume of lilacs in a vase on the kitchen table, making dinner together on Sunday nights and eating ice cream for dessert, searching for her mother's face in the school auditorium during the spelling bee. Her journal holds the antiseptic stink of the hospital, the tubes and wires and gentle hum of machinery, the way pain bloomed in a dark rose on her mother's face and clouded up her eyes, the steady drip of morphine, counting the days and the weeks and the months until the malignancy finally stole her away. She sits in front of the facility and sheds her last bit of mourning, the memory of a baby still and silent in her arms. She will remember the movements beneath her skin, the way her shape changed, the cocoa butter rubbed on her belly and thighs. She wants to give up the panic in the delivery room, the nurse's tearful apologies, the tiny casket. Waking up every day with a throat raw from weeping and an empty hollow in the place where her heart should be. The way everyone said, perhaps it was for the best. She was so young. She had plenty of time. This is the deepest hole of them all, a place all tangled up inside, its edges cutting her with every movement, every breath. She needs to be free so she can breathe again. The hallways of the facility are as familiar as her own home by now. The nurse greets her by name and offers a hug instead of a touch on the hand. When it's over, she goes home and tucks the notebook away, and she smiles. On a cold day in December, she wakes to discover a stranger in the mirror. The woman smiles too easily. The worry lines have vanished from her brow, and there's a light in her eyes that doesn't quite fit. "Are you the me I should have been?" she whispers. "Or the me I never could?" The stranger says not a word. Of course not. She doesn't know pain or loss or grief. She knows nothing but the absence of such things, of gray spaces filled up with nothing. Unbidden, tears blur her vision and spill over her lashes. She flees from the reflection and finds the journal, wiping her eyes dry with the back of her hand so she can read. Page after page, she sees not sorrow, but strength. Not defects, but all the bits and pieces that make a person whole. She turns the pages faster and faster. Inside, she's a broken puzzle that can't put its pieces back together. An ache coils in her chest. A yearning for the things they took away, the things that shaped the curve of her smile and the set of her jaw. She wants a familiar face in the mirror, not the stranger. She wants everything back the way it was. She wants herself the way it was. The tears fall anew. They taste of dandelion and talcum powder and ashes. She clutches the journal tight, crying for what she cannot remember. For all the things she wanted to forget, to throw away like a toy full of broken. But the knowledge comes too late, far too late. The procedure is irreversible. All she has left is a journal of memories that belong to someone else, someone she once knew.
This is Eric Benrood. The story is titled Fig Prince by Eric Horowitz. The queen has an obsession with figs. She knew that wasps laid their eggs inside of them and that the hatchlings ate their way out. This gave her the idea for how to arrange the baby's nursery in a way that her child could grow up into the kind of creature she greatly admired. She commissioned a bulbous dome to be built of gold and porphyry and partially lined on the inside with red velvet. Inside, her engineers spread a golden mesh to conceal a metallic pipe at the bottom. An occupant would spend his life in this comfortable golden net, fed by the clockwork above him, which they designed to gently deliver spheres of peeled fruit. Any waste sluiced through the bottom to be promptly drained. They sealed the baby within this cavernous contraption where he presumably still lives, for fruit still comes in at the top and shit still drained out the bottom. The queen must intend for the boy's tutelage to be the escape from this dome, that his childhood would end when he figures out how to emerge from the nursery. Quite frankly, we are all terrified of what's going to come out.
This is Kim Stamegna, and I'm reading Trophy Wife by Samantha Murray. He wore her heart on his sleeve. It was where he kept all of his trophies. Stitched onto the ceremonial garment that proclaimed him Garag the Victor. He had 7 now. 7 life organs, from 7 species, from 7 planets. 7 was lucky. He knew that too, and he held himself with more than his usual pride. Let those who watched envy him. He had warmed to her planet. It reminded him of his own home, something about the openness. He had undergone the change to appear as one of her species. Of course, the form was lighter and less cumbersome than the last few he had assumed. He put out his call through their finicky language and sent it out over their communication channels. He showed an image of himself. Many of them responded. He had heard some call it the battle of the sexes, and the thing that he had been best at since he had spawned was battle. Then he found the perfect one. What made her just right, he could not have said. She chewed at the end of her fingers quite often, and she looked up at him quickly and then down and away. They walked at the edge of the landmass, where the water that stretched out was the same color as the eyes of his current form, and the fine sand underfoot was the same color as the hair on his head. Her eyes and her hair were not these colors. They were the light warm shade of the fur of his previous conquest. That last time he had won a match of speed and strength with the sharpness of his claws and the need in his gut. Here he understood the rules were different. He liked the place by the water. It stirred something in him. She said she liked it too and bared her teeth. She told him many things, the things she wanted and the things that had wounded her. He listened because he liked the sounds her words made, and he watched how she moved her head and fluttered her hands. He took her back to the water then and waited until their small sun had sunk half down into it like it was a fire drowning. Then he looked directly into her eyes and said, "I want you to give me your heart." And more of the water that was so abundant on her planet came out of her eyes and streaked down her face. And she said that she would.
My name is Anthony Spivey, and I'll be reading Protocol by Tony Bowman. "Now that we're in hyperspace, could you please tell me what you dragged me out of my vodka nap for?" Cassandra asked. Fowler lay down on the lounge cross from her and rubbed his gray stubbled chin. "A couple of months ago, we recovered a probe just outside Neptune's orbit. It popped out of hyperspace and started emitting RF across multiple frequencies. Took 6 weeks to decipher the contents." "Who sent it?" Cassandra asked, drawing her knees up and hugging them. "They call themselves the Matak. They're not on anybody's known list. Brand new species," Fowler said, pressing the wrinkles out of his uniform pants. Cassandra's smooth brow furrowed. "This is a meet-and-greet mission? What the hell do you need me for?" Fowler shook his head. "Not quite a meet-and-greet. The information in the probe says that the Matak are currently at war. They're requesting assistance. The rest of the information is cultural, diplomatic protocols, and the hyperspace coordinates of their homeworld."
"What?"
"You heard me. The coordinates of their homeworld," Fowler said, returning her bemused expression.
"What kind of idiots send out the coordinates of their homeworld?" Cassandra asked. "That's like telling a thief the combination to your safe and leaving the back door open."
"Desperate idiots," Fowler said. "We can only assume they're in very dire straits." "I thought standard Milcourt policy was to stay out of alien conflicts." "Normally it is. I guess I should have pointed out the Mitak hyperspace probe was a cylinder, 2 meters long, half a meter in diameter, Fowler said, a grin spreading across his pale features. Cassandra looked at him, her green eyes wide. You can't make a hyperdrive that small. The smallest drive known is 50 meters long and half again as wide. The physics gurus are taking it apart as we speak. It uses some technologies that have them stumped so far. Oh, now I get why I'm going. You need someone to pry into their databases, Cassandra said. Exactly. While I'm negotiating with them, you get everything you can on their technology. Also, everything you can on whoever it is they're at war with, Fowler explained. Cassandra shook her head. What makes you think they'll even talk to us? Obviously, they're way ahead of us technologically. What could we offer them? Fowler tended his fingers and stared at the nails. We used a cruiser and deposited our own probe just outside their system. With the information inside, we introduced ourselves and described a recent conflict we had with a neighboring species called the Wumpus. The what? Totally fictional. We told them we destroyed the Wumpus with our quantum singularity projectors, Fowler said. What the hell is a quantum singularity projector? Cassandra asked. Hopefully they won't know either. Cassandra frowned. So we're going to lie to them, give them false hope and steal their technology. Fowler simply looked at his hands. She shook her head. We're scum, Fowler. You do realize that. We've become interstellar con artists. It's called survival, Major. We have lots of enemies. There's no room for our scruples here, Fowler said, his cold gray eyes boring into her. Maybe not, but it doesn't mean I have to like it, Colonel, Cassandra said. Fowler shrugged. We'll arrive in 2 hours. He picked up a printout and stared at the words. I have to memorize this word, he said, pointing it out to her. The word was at least 80 syllables long. Cassandra whistled. Mitech language? What does it mean? No translation. It's a word of greeting I am to say when I introduce us. The Mitech are sticklers for protocol, Fowler said, and began to whisper the word over and over to himself. 2 hours later, the Milcorp ship Zephyr emerged from hyperspace and entered orbit around the Mitech homeworld. Zephyr, a sleek tadpole-shaped cruiser, was the fastest ship in the Earth Military Corporation fleet. Like all other hyperdrive ships, the Zephyr had 3 navigators on board. The hyperspace of coordinates of Earth and her colonies were not written down. No database contained them. The navigators memorized the coordinates during their training. Their sole function aboard the ship, for which they were paid incredible sums of money, was to enter the coordinates into the drive controller when necessary. At all other times, they were kept in guarded rooms aboard the ship. The rooms were called kill rooms by the crew, and for good reason. The rooms were designed to incinerate the navigator within should the ship be boarded or disabled, lest they be forced to divulge their secrets. As the kill rooms were locked, leaving the navigators to their lonely existences, Major Cassandra Owens and Colonel Fowler McVeigh boarded the Zephyr's landing skiff. The skiff dropped from the belly of the Zephyr and cruised toward the red-tinged world below. Cassandra looked at the swirling red clouds and cursed under her breath. "You have something to say?" Fowler asked as he guided the craft through the upper atmosphere. "Nothing new, except I'm resigning my commission after this one, Colonel," Cassandra growled. "I'll be sorry to see you go," he said. "I'm tired of the lies. I'm tired of the end justifying the means." "I think you've said enough, Cassandra," Fowler said. "Anything more might be construed as insubordination or treason." She glared at him. "I'll do my filthy job, Colonel. Don't you worry. I just hope they're half the scumbags we are, so I won't see this place in my dreams when I retire." Fowler winced and nodded. The skiff sped through red whirling clouds. Cassandra watched the sensors. Lots of particulate metallics in the atmosphere. The red tinge is coming from oxidation. A little less nitrogen in their atmosphere than ours. Oxygen levels slightly higher. Breathable, but we better wear respirators if we're outdoors. Beautiful, isn't it? Yes, Fowler said. The instructions from the Mitech probe specified the coordinates for their landing. Fowler brought the skiff through a cloud bank, and a walled city appeared below. Graceful white spires reached up into the rust-colored sky. He lowered the landing skids, and the skiff touched down on a platform that clung to one of the tall spires. As the landing thrusters wound down, a circular door opened in the spire, and Cassandra saw her first Mitech. Their pale, purplish, hairless bodies were long and sleek with four legs, two short legs behind and two longer legs in the front. Their chests were long and narrow, with four slender arms and a tall neck. Each stared at the skiff with four narrow white eyes arranged in a square. They evolved in low gravity. This planet has low gravity. Probably means they weren't lying about this being their homeworld, Cassandra said, as she stepped to the hatch and opened it. The cool air with its slight metallic odor whipped at her blonde hair. She proceeded Fowler down the skiff's hatch steps and stood to the side. Colonel Fowler stepped down after her and approached the two Mittak who stood on the platform. I am... The Mittak closest to him shrank back and clucked in an odd gurgle. Damn, forgot about the protocol. Fowler thought and began to pronounce the 80-syllable Mittak word for hello. The Mittak leaned closer to him and nodded slowly as he spoke, scrawling long, flowery symbols on a pad that looked to Cassandra like red clay. When Fowler finished the recitation, the Mittak chirped and nodded. It turned to the other Mittak and showed the pad. The second Mittak nodded, and the first walked away into the spire. The Mittak who remained turned the corners of his tiny lips up in a smile. It clearly was an alien accustomed to the graceful Mittak. Fowler returned the smile. The Mittak spoke. I am called Loss. I represent the Mittak. You would see me as a diplomat from your reference. I'm Colonel Fowler McVeigh. This is Major Owens. We represent the Earth Military Corporation, Fowler said, and after a pause, you would see me as a diplomat also. Loss bowed his head and smiled. Please follow along beside me, Loss said, and he led the way into the spire. The light of the white circular corridor was so bright that Cassandra winced. Please forgive that I am the only one here to welcome you, Loss said as they walked. The Mittak are at war. The needs of the conflict are many, the resources few. The probe said you were at war, Fowler said. Yes. The Keck have advanced far today. Soon they will stand at our door and demand entry. Without help, the Mittak will be no more, Loss said, lowering his eyes as he spoke. They stepped into a large circular room of bright white. Loss sat down on the floor, folding his legs under him. Fowler and Cassandra sat across from him. Colonel Fowler McVeigh, the Mittak would like to negotiate for your quantum singularity projector technology, Loss said, gesturing with his hands as he spoke. Right to the point, Cassandra thought. Loss, you must understand, this technology is one of our most important achievements. We cannot give it away without... Fowler began. Loss waved a right hand. Whatever you want from us, Colonel Fowler McVeigh, the Mittak will give. Your situation is desperate? Fowler asked. Loss nodded, turning his eyes down in their way of communicating sorrow. Once, Mittak spread out across the galaxy. The Mittak travel always in peace, never with the thought of conquest. The Mittak had many trading partners. Then came the Keck. Loss pointed to the wall. A three-dimensional image appeared in the air beside Cassandra. The creature was a biped, 3 meters tall. Red armor covered it from head to toe, the armor's surface bristling with projections and technologies Cassandra could not identify. The lizard-like face stared at the opposite wall through lifeless black eyes. The Keck go nowhere in peace. Where they go, death follows. The Keck came to the Mittak when the Mittak held 1,000 colonies. Now the Mittak hold only this world, Loss said. Their technology is beyond yours? Fowler asked. The Keck best the Mittak in all things, Loss said, nodding in sorrow. I'm sorry, Fowler said. The Keck are much like the Wumpus you defeated, Loss said, his eyes rising in hope. The Keck have no quantum singularity projector. Loss, when we went to war with the Wumpus, there was a clear threat to our world, Fowler explained. Cassandra winced at the name of the made-up race. This really stinks, she thought. The Keck are a threat to all, not just the Mittak, Loss said. Yes, but they are not an imminent threat. The galaxy is a big place. It could take thousands of years before Earth has to deal with them, Fowler said. Loss lowered his eyes, this time all the way to the floor. You will not help them attack. I must confer with my homeworld, Loss, Fowler said, and stood. We are a compassionate civilization. Provide Major Owens with your databases. We will take the data back to Earth. Our superiors will decide how to proceed. Loss looked up. Then there is hope for them attack. Of course, as I said, we are a compassionate species. A few hours later, Cassandra sat in the lounge chair aboard Zephyr and looked over the translated databases. The sum of Mittak's science, philosophy, and history lay at her fingertips. Amazing stuff, she said. Is it? Fowler asked, rubbing his eyes. They're at least 500 years ahead of us, and these Keck are probably that far ahead of them. Terrifying, Cassandra said. The Keck are bloodthirsty, and they have a population the Mittak estimate at 10 trillion. Trillion? Fowler whispered. Cassandra nodded. I hope we have a few hundred years to prepare ourselves before we encounter them. They could overwhelm us by sheer numbers alone. Outnumber us 500 to 1 and outclass us technologically by about a millennium. Yes, I'd say we'd better avoid them as long as possible, Fowler said and closed his eyes. Zephyr would be ready to enter hyperspace in 10 minutes, and he would be happy to put this sad world behind him. A voice came over the intercom. Colonel Fowler, we are receiving a transmission from the Mittak homeworld. Wonder what they want. I'll take it in here, Lieutenant, Fowler said. A moment later, Loss's voice filled the room. Colonel Fowler McVeigh, excuse my interruption. Not at all, Loss. What can we do for you? Fowler replied. I have spoken to the Mittak elders, and I am sorry. You must understand, the Mittak stand on the edge of extinction, Loss said. Cassandra looked at Fowler in confusion. What do you mean, Loss? He asked. I told them your world would probably not help unless they were in imminent danger. Earth is now in imminent danger, Loss said. Explain, Fowler said. There was a pause. Mittak has sent a message to the Keck, giving them the coordinates of your homeworld. You don't have Earth's coordinates, Cassandra cried. Loss answered, sadly, yes. You see, we sent out millions of probes seeking aid. Each probe had a different 80-digit code, corresponding to the random coordinates of its destination. The greeting you used when you arrived identified your coordinates. Oh, my God, Cassandra thought. Fowler's face turned ashen. Why would you? A subterfuge for which I apologize, but do not fear. The Keck are no match for your quantum singularity projectors. The elders are confident that together, Mittak and Earth will defeat the Keck.
You've been listening to Science Fiction Shorts on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Kurt Benrud. My team of volunteer readers and I thank you for listening in, and we would love to have you join us next time. Just a quick reminder, this program is available in podcast, and it is intended for an audience that is blind or print impaired. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. As always, our number is 832-5138, and that's 919-832-5138. If you're a fan of sci-fi and have something to say, we want to hear from you.